Showtime. Let's do a little mic check. How do I sound? I'm trying out the wired headphones. Staticky. Not great. A lot of static. Not much of that. I have other microphones. I can try those out. Hang on.
Yeah, that's right. I'm mining cryptocurrencies. Alright, we're gonna give this another shot. How's this audio? Is this better or still bad? Awful audio, too much feedback. Take out headphones. I am using the AirPods now. Is this better? Still too noisy? Much better? Okay, better, better. Uh-oh. I could always try something different, but I would have to leave Periscope and come back in. Okay, sounds like we're in a blender. Well, I'll let people keep joining in. I'm going to go and see if I can reduce the background noise. I will return. Okay, let's see, that should have reduced the background noise a bit. Great, it's still not great. I need to get a lavalier mic, my apologies. I figured it would be better to do bad audio than no audio. So why don't we just go ahead with this? Great, so as you probably, many of you know, I had this tweet storm that I put up a few days back, almost a week back, and it went insanely viral. So I figured that's a topic that everybody would want to talk about. And the topic is, of course, how to get rich, which I thought would be a really crass topic that people would just sort of attack me. I didn't think it would be very popular, but it turned out to be a very popular topic. Everybody wants to make money, and we live in a difficult society where everybody pretends like they don't want to make money, but in the reality is everybody does want to make money. Because it can really help out, with all your material possessions. Anyway, that's enough for that's enough on the feedback on the audio. Otherwise, I'm not going to talk much. All right, so we're going to talk about the tweet storm, about how to make money. The bad lighting was deliberate. I'm doing you a favor with the bad lighting. Trust me on that. You don't want the good lighting. Money buys you freedom in the material world. It's not going to make you happy. It's not going to solve necessarily your health problems. It's not going to make your family great. It's not going to make you fit. It's not going to make you calm. But it will solve a lot of your external problems. And so I think it's a reasonable step to go ahead and make money. So I grew up poor and miserable. And I learned how to make money and be happy. And so those are the two things that I think like I have some insight on. So I would like to be able to communicate that to people who are interested to the extent that it helps them. And of course, one of the problems with talking about this stuff in social media is that there are a lot of people who are really attached to not making money or who are really attached to not being happy. And so it's very difficult to talk about these topics because those people don't want to feel bad about their choices. And so they feel the need to sort of try to shut down these conversations. Or sometimes they try to, gain status by attacking people who are trying to talk about these topics. But they're important topics because these are not zero-sum games. These are positive-sum games. Everybody in the world can be happy. Everybody in the world can be wealthy. And I think that it's just a matter of education, know-how, and effort. These are worthwhile things to work on. And if someone doesn't want to make money and if someone doesn't want to be happy, then you don't belong here. So I'm sorry that you decide not to do that. Hey, whoever's talking about Elon getting attacked, I'm going to block you. So if you're going off topic, someone keeps going off topic, that's out. Okay, great. So we're trying to have a civil conversation here. So if people start just kind of jumping in with all caps, then we have to unfortunately remove them. It's, you know, they're bad audience members. All right, so we're going to talk today about making money. And firstly, I'm going to go through the tweet storm itself. That tweet storm, by the way, was about 40 tweets, and I actually had close to 100. So there were a large number of them that I just left on the cutting room floor because I thought they were a little bit off topic or they wouldn't make for as coherent or cogent of an argument. But obviously, how to make money is a very deep topic. It's one that we can talk about for hours and days. So, someone's saying I can deactivate comments. That's interesting. I'll leave them on for now, but if they get really annoying, I'll block people or I'll just delete them. I could read out all 100 tweets, but they're not in order, so it wouldn't be coherent, and a lot of it wouldn't make sense. Part of what I did was I tried to create a message that would be easily packaged, and frankly, 40 tweets is already too many. If you notice that tweet storm, by the way, for those of you who are active on Twitter, there were a couple of things about that tweet storm that were very deliberately crafted. I didn't have tweet numbers, so I didn't say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, because that would make it harder to spread individual tweets from the tweet storm. It also makes it feel more mechanical and less timeless. A second thing that I did very deliberately is each tweet is written so that it makes sense standalone. So if you have no context of who I am or what I'm talking about, and you see a single one of those tweets show up in your feed, it still makes sense. So what that means is it makes the entire tweet storm randomly accessible. And so it makes the whole thing very viral. They're independent standalone tweets. So to the people out there who are translating them, I encourage you to keep the one tweet per, one translation of each tweet per tweet format, and not try to bundle like four tweets into one translation tweet. And also to not add numbers to it, because it actually lowers the spread vector, lowers the virality. For those of you who are having bad audio, I'm sorry. It's either that or no audio, so we can just not do this. That's unfortunately my only other option, but I promise you, for the next one, I will get a lavalier mic. I'll get the best one money could buy, and we're going to have great sound. So it's like Trump says, you're going to love the sound. But right now, you just got to deal with what we have. So let's talk about the different tweets and the different concepts. Yeah, first is, how long does it take to make money? It takes decades. It's going to take longer than you would like. But the best time to start was yesterday. The second best time is now. So you may as well start, if it's something you're thinking about, it's fine to start working on it now. And it may take a while for it to pay out. But when it does start paying out, you will essentially have, it's not that you will have made money, but you will have become the kind of person that makes money. And once you're the kind of person that makes money and you have some comfort around that, then you essentially have your freedom. So you're basically going to learn the skills on how to make money. You're going to become a money-making machine. And once you're a money-making machine, the goal is that 10 or 20 years from now, that you will get hit by a tsunami of money and you will know how it's coming at you. Yeah, by the way, there's some people in the threads who are talking about crypto. Yes, if you were in crypto at the right time, you made a bunch of money. But to even be in crypto at the right time required you to be a certain kind of person who was more amenable to making money. For example, to make money in crypto, it helped to have had a love of the technology early on. It helped to be a quick learner. It helped to already have some capital put away. It helped to know what kinds of risks are worth taking and which ones aren't. So let me answer a question that I keep coming up. Does this only apply to the US? You know, some of it, sure. Like if you want to be a technology business and you don't live in a technology hub, that's difficult. But on the other hand, some of these principles are timeless. For example, owning equity in a business being the only real path towards making money over time. That applies across the board. Compound interest, that applies across the board. Let me start off with just talking about ownership versus wage work. So if you are getting paid for renting out your time, and that even includes lawyers and includes doctors, you can make some money. You're just not going to make the kind of money that gives you your financial freedom. You're not going to have passive income where a business is earning for you while you sleep and while you are on vacation. So when you own equity in a company, that basically means you own the upside. When you own debt, you own guaranteed revenue streams and you own the downside. You want to own equity. If you don't own equity in a business, then I think your odds of making money are very slim. So you have to kind of walk up to the point where you can own equity in a business. And you can own equity as a small shareholder where you've bought stock, but you can also own it as an owner where you started the company. So ownership is really important. By the way, as an aside, I did tweet out a little addendum to the thread, which most people missed. But if you can only remember two words, I'm going to give you the whole tweet storm in two words now, if you're paying attention. And these are very important. Both words are loaded. And because I have to compress them down to two words, you have to get it precisely. But anytime you are trying to figure out what to do, think of these two words: productize yourself. Okay, so basically, not productive yourself, productize yourself. What you're going to do is you're going to create a product out of whatever it is that you naturally and uniquely do really, really well. Okay, of course, you have to read the tweet storm to understand what those two words mean and to get a lot of the context, but just those two, you can carry those in your heads. Productize yourself. You're building a product. That product is a set of things that you uniquely know how to do that hopefully society wants that you can leverage and scale up. But products by their nature are leveraged. Products by their nature are scaled up. And yourself means that you don't get to compete at being somebody else. Because if you compete at being somebody else, you're not going to be the best in the world at it. And if you're not the best in the world at it, you will not get rewarded properly for it. So yes, it's how do you package yourself in a product. It's hard. This is why I say it takes decades. Not necessarily because it just takes decades to execute, but the better part of a decade may just be used figuring out what it is that you can uniquely provide. So I'm going to get now into compound interest and specific knowledge. I think compound interest comes up a lot. Specific knowledge is also something that I think is a difficult concept to wrap your head around. So let's talk about compound interest. Compound interest, most of you should know it in the finance context. If you don't, then crack open a microeconomics textbook. It's worth reading microeconomics textbook through from start to finish. Macroeconomics, you can skip for the most part. As Nassim Taleb says, it is much easier to macro bullshit than it is to micro bullshit. So with macroeconomics, there's just so much politics that bleeds into macroeconomics, especially once you're beyond the basics of supply and demand, that it's very hard to tell when you're reading politics with a little bit of mathematics around it and when you're actually reading something that's more fundamental. So compound interest is basically the idea that, let's say if you're earning 10% a year, the first year you make 10% and you end up with, let's say you had a dollar you invested, you end up with $1.10. But the next year you end up with $1.21. And the next year you end up with $1.32 or $1.33. So it keeps adding on itself in such a way that if you're compounding at 30% a year for 30 years, you don't just end up with 10 or 20 times your money, you end up with thousands of times your money. So compound interest is a very powerful concept. But compound interest applies to more than just compounding capital. Compounding capital is just the beginning. Compounding business relationships is very important. If you look at some of the top roles in society, like why does someone get to be a CEO of a public company or be on the board of a public company, or why does someone get to be a banker who's managing $1 billion, is because people trust them. And they trust them because the relationship in which they've worked, the work that they've done, it's kind of compounded. They've stuck with the business and they've shown themselves in a visible and accountable way to be high integrity people. So compound interest can also happen in your reputation. If you have a sterling reputation and you do a good job with it and you keep doing that for decades upon decades, people will notice that and your reputation will literally end up being thousands to tens of thousands of times as valuable as somebody else who is actually very talented but is not keeping a kind of the compound interest game and reputation going. This is also true when you're working with individual people. So if you've worked with somebody in a business where they're your coworker and you work together for 5 or 10 years and you still enjoy working with them, obviously you trust them. The little foibles are gone. All the negotiations that normally would happen to business relationships can work very, very simply because you just trust each other. You know it'll work out. For example, there's another angel in Silicon Valley, Elad Gil, who I like to do deals with. And the reason I love working with Elad is because I know that when the deal is being done, he will bend over backwards to give me extra. He will always round off in my favor if there's an extra dollar being delivered here or there. If there's some cost to pay, he'll pay it out of his own pocket, and he won't even mention it to me. And because he goes so far out of his way to treat me so well, I send him every deal that I have. I try and include him in everything, and then I go out of my way to try and pay for him. So that relationship just ends up so powerful that the 1+1 is more than 2 as investors here. So compounding in those relationships is very valuable. Even like fitness and health, many of you have probably been on various diets and nutrition programs and exercise programs, and you probably notice that it takes a little while before you kind of go through these growth spurts. And then once you've gone through a spurt, you kind of land at a new level, either you're thinner or you're more muscular, and then you can jump up to the next level from there. Obviously, fitness, we're talking about physiological. Compound interest is not going to work anywhere near as strongly as it will in the purely intellectual domain. But in the intellectual domain, compound interest rules. Even when you look at a business that may have 100 users, but is growing at a compound rate of 20% a month, will very, very quickly stack up to having millions of users. And sometimes even the founders of the companies are surprised by how large the business scales. So when you find the right thing to do, when you find the right people to work with, then just investing deeply into that and sticking with it for decades is really how you make the big bucks and you make the big returns in your relationships and in your money. So compound interest is very important. Actually, am I high? No, I'm not high, but guess what? You're blocked. So, sorry, I'm tossing out people who are just throwing in silly comments. How does one escape 9-to-5? Escaping the 9-to-5 grind is actually very difficult. And one of the big problems that many of us have in life, and I faced this early on too, is you just get sucked into being busy. And you get sucked into being busy because you have a job. The job kind of chews up all of your time from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. You get home, you're exhausted. How are you supposed to work on anything else? So I think the key there is trying to find a career or a job or an education where you will end up in a business where the inputs and the outputs are disconnected. What I mean by that is, let's say that you're growing up in the world 2,000 years ago. Almost all the jobs you could have back then, the inputs and the outputs are very tightly connected. So if you go and you have to go cut wood, you spend 4 hours cutting wood, you get 4 hours worth of cutting wood output. There'll be very slight difference between the two. But nowadays, you have knowledge worker jobs, you have intellectual jobs, programming being my favorite example, where a good developer can write a piece of code that can literally make your business hundreds of millions of dollars over the next few years. And there are developers who can write code all day long. And just because they're creating the wrong thing, it's actually not creating value no matter how hard they work. So yeah, customers don't care about inputs. They only care about outcomes and outputs. So if you can navigate towards a career where you're tracked on the output, you're going to do much better. What are examples of careers? So I gave coding as an example, but actually sales is another one of those examples, and especially very expensive sales, very high-end sales. So if you're out there, for example, if you're selling houses, if you're a real estate agent, right? Not a great job necessarily, very, very crowded. But if you're a top flight real estate agent, you know how to market yourself, you know how to sell houses, it's possible you could sell $5 million mansions in a tenth the time that somebody else is struggling to sell $100,000 apartments or condos. So that is a job where input and output are highly disconnected. Coding and sales, what else? Well, actually building any product and selling any product. And fundamentally, what else is there? So what you don't necessarily want to be in is a support role, like a customer service kind of role. For example, customer service, unfortunately, inputs and outputs map relatively closely towards each other. The amount of hours put in matters. So it helps to move towards things that have these skill sets where it's very hard to match inputs to outputs. So it's a little hard to pay attention with all the different questions going by, but I'm gonna stop for a second. I'm gonna scan the questions. I'm gonna try and look for themes. One question is, with 7 billion people, can everyone do this? Absolutely, absolutely. Every one of 7 billion people in the world can do something interesting and different and productized. Let me give you a thought experiment, okay? Here's the thought experiment. I want you to seriously think about this. Don't just take my word for it. But assume that everyone in the world had maximum practical knowledge. Like everyone could go create hardware and robots, everyone could go write code, everyone could go and invest money, everyone could do mathematics. So if we were all maximally educated, then what would happen? I think within 5 years, robots would be doing all of the manual labor, we would all be doing creative work, and we would essentially all be wealthy. We would have figured out how to program machines and use technology to do everything that we need to do other than the creative work. And so at that point, we would be either furthering science and technology and inventing brand new things, or we would be doing creative work for each other. There are a small number of true zero-sum games in the world. Status, you know, all the status games are zero-sum. But most of the things that we care about when we talk about wealth, like cars and houses and clean water and air travel and all of those things, those are not zero-sum games. Those are positive-sum games. You can get really, really, really far with automation. So I do think it's possible for 7 billion people to have 7 billion products. Remember, we used to live in an age where almost everybody was farmers. There was a time when it was unimaginable that there would be a class of people who did anything other than farming, except for a very, very thin layer of society. And now farmers are like 1% of the developed world. So obviously we've left that behind, and we have already started to move much larger numbers of people into creative professions. Yeah, someone mentioned Nassim Taleb's Skin in the Game. That is the best book I read in 2018. I highly recommend it for everybody. It's got lots and lots of great ideas in there, lots of good mental models and constructs. Nassim isn't the easy. He has a bit of an attitude, but he has that because he's brilliant, and it's okay. So just look past that and read the book, learn the concepts. Taleb's Skin of the Game is one of the best business books I've ever read, and luckily it doesn't masquerade as a business book. Skin in the Game is the name of the book. Skin in the Game. Yeah, so learning to sell. Let's talk about sales skills, because this goes into specific knowledge. Sales skills are a form of specific knowledge. Really good salespeople, I think you can be trained, so it's not to say you can't learn it, but really, there's such a thing as a natural in sales, and you run into them all the time in the industry that I'm in. And when you meet someone who is a natural at sales, you just know that they're amazing and they're really good at what they do. That is a form of specific knowledge. Now, obviously, they learned that somewhere, but they didn't learn that in a classroom setting. They learned that probably in their childhood, in a schoolyard. They learned it negotiating with their parents. Maybe some of it is a genetic component in their DNA. And you can improve it. You can read Robert Cialdini. You can go to a sales training seminar. You can do door-to-door sales, which is brutal, but will train you very quickly. So you can definitely improve your sales skills, but a lot of sales is this specific knowledge that you learn just by doing, especially at a very early age. So when I talk about specific knowledge, I talk about what I'm basically saying is, figure out what is it that you were doing as a kid or as a teenager almost effortlessly that you didn't even consider a skill, but people around you notice, like your mother would know, your best friend growing up would know. And to give you examples of what it could be sales skills. It could be that you were just musically talented and you just had the ability to pick up any instrument. It could be that you had an obsessive personality, so you would dive into things and learn them very quickly. It could be that you had a love for science fiction, so you were into sci-fi, you were into reading, which means that you can absorb lots of knowledge very quickly. It could have been you were playing a lot of games, so you actually understand game theory pretty well. It could even be, you know, you were out there gossiping and digging into your friend network, and that might make you into a very interesting kind of journalist. But a specific knowledge is sort of this weird combination of unique traits from your DNA combined with your unique upbringing and your response to it. And it's almost baked into your personality and your identity. And then you can hone it. So for example, I love to read and I love technology. So I learn very, very quickly and I get bored fast, just like one of the commentators mentioned. I have that same issue. So if I had gone into a profession that required me to tunnel down for 20 years into the same topic, it wouldn't work. But because I'm in venture investing, which requires me to come up to speed very, very quickly on new technologies, and it kind of rewards getting bored because there's always a new technology coming along to evaluate, it matches up pretty well with my specific knowledge and skill sets. People are talking about Robert Cialdini. Robert Cialdini wrote a book called Influence. And Influence is a book on persuasion. It is one of the best books, one of the best business and skill books ever written. And I can recommend it for everybody who's listening to this to read it. What Cialdini talks about is how you persuade people, how you convince people to do things. What are the tricks? What are the strategies? And it turns out that most of these strategies work really well, even if you know that they're being used on you. They're that good, because we as humans are emotionally and behaviorally hardwired through evolution to fall for these strategies. And the book is called Influence by Robert Cialdini, C-I-A-L-D-I-N-I. And the key takeaway in Cialdini is CLASSR, C-L-A-S-S-R. That's an acronym, and it stands for how you persuade people. The C is consistency. People want to be consistent with their past actions. So if they did something before, then they kind of wrap that into their identity and they want to be consistent and do that kind of action again. So example, Benjamin Franklin used to have this trick where if he wanted someone who didn't like him, if he had a social enemy, he would go to them and he would ask them to borrow a book. And it was kind of awkward because, especially back when he was alive, books were rare, books were expensive, and books were things to be treasured. But at the same time, you always wanted to teach people. So he would say, let me borrow a book from you. And if somebody said, sure, you know, here's the book, and they were his enemy, they'd feel a little awkward and they'd loan him the book. Then later, when he came back and returned the book and was nice to them again, they would think, well, I loaned him the book in the past. Therefore, I wouldn't loan a book to someone I didn't like. Therefore, I must like him. So just to be consistent with their past action, they would like him more. So that's how consistency works. Liking is obvious. That's the L in class R. That if somebody likes you, they're more likely to be persuaded by you. So just be nice to them. A is for authority. So for example, you're more likely to listen to a doctor about medical advice than you are about a non-doctor. So that's why you have the infomercial saying, you know, recommended by X dentists or Y doctors. The next S is scarcity, which is, you know, there's only a few of these left. It's disappearing. Grab it fast now. It's like the used car salesman saying, this is the last one I have left in the lot. The second S stands for social proof, which is monkey see, monkey do. So when, you know, if you see your friends doing something, then you'll do it. The simplest example of this is just go stand on the street and start looking up, and pretty soon other people around you will all be looking up. And then R is reciprocity, which is people always want to repay you, and sometimes they can't do the math on what things are worth. So for example, the Hare Krishnas in the airport will come up to you and they'll give you a flower, or they'll give you like a copy of the Bhagavad Gita, and then they'll ask for a donation. And the donation is often like out of proportion to what the book was worth. So that's kind of the code that Cialdini gets to his book, Class R. That's kind of what you need to remember. Scott Adams has a great blog where he goes in much more detail about more modern techniques of persuasion, including ones that Trump uses, such as linguistic kill shots and assuming the sale and anchoring in negotiations and so on. So I think persuasion is one of those foundational skills that everybody should learn, at least the basic theories around it. And Robert Cialdini and Scott Adams' blogs are probably the two places that I would start. I'm going to wait till a few more questions go by. Otherwise, I'll go back to my covering the tweet storm. One thing I don't want to do this time around, which I think I've done in previous Periscopes, if I've answered lots of random one-off questions, and I'm not sure it appeals to everybody. I'm drinking tea, by the way. What other foundational skills are there in addition to persuasion? I think basic mathematics is really underrated. So if you're going to make money, if you're going to invest money, your basic math should be really good. You don't need to learn geometry or trigonometry or calculus or any of that stuff, not if you're just going into business. But arithmetic, probability, and statistics, those are extremely important. Crack open a basic math book. Just make sure you're really good at multiplying, dividing, compounding, manipulating numbers, and probability and statistics, very, very important. And there's a new branch of probability and statistics, which is really around tail events, black swans, extreme probabilities. And again, I have to refer back to Nassim Taleb, who I think is one of the greatest philosopher scientists of our times. And he's really done a lot of pioneering work on this. You can also read about it through complexity theory. But complexity theory and sort of the mathematics of complex events and chaotic events, I think is really important. Basic accounting is also helpful, although you don't need to go get a degree in accounting. And frankly, accounting is really boring. The good news is most of accounting turns out to be common sense. Calculus is useful to know, to understand rates of change and how nature works. But it's sort of more important to understand the principles of calculus, where you're measuring the change in small, discrete, or small continuous events, rather than it's important that you be able to solve integrals or do derivations on demand, because you're not going to need to do that in the business world. Frankly, once you're done with probability, statistics, and basic arithmetic, the most you're going to need to know is how to manipulate Excel. Is programming becoming a commodity skill? No. By definition, programming cannot be a commodity skill. I know there are a lot of people, usually people who aren't programmers, who say, well, in the future, computers will write code. No, they won't. The coding is a general AI task. It is basically taking something, a construct in your brain, constructing a logical construct, doing something very, very creative, and then having it solve intellectual problems or repeat solutions to previously solved intellectual problems. Coding is very difficult, and you can see that the top coders in the world, people like Notch, who made Minecraft, or Satoshi Nakamoto, or John Carmack, these people can literally make billions of dollars of value, while someone who's sort of a not very good coder can literally just create no value. So the spread is so large, and that tells you that it's a creative task. It's just like the Mona Lisa is a much better painting than anything I can throw together in an afternoon, and it's much better by an almost infinite amount. So when you see that kind of variation in outcomes, that tells you that that job is highly creative and is not likely to be automated in our lifetimes. If it does get automated, it will be through a general AI, and the moment there's a general AI, this whole game is over. We have nothing left to talk about because everything changes. What would I major in today? That is a good question if I were to go to college today. So I'm actually not a huge fan of the current university system, at least in terms of the cost that it imposes on you, both in terms of opportunity cost as well as in financial cost. In exchange, you get credentialing, you get an alumni network, but you've spent 4 years of your life and an enormous amount of money. So if you are going to go to the university, then the first rule is learn things that you can't learn by yourself. Because most things you can learn by yourself at home. When I went to university, I started out doing English and history. Actually, originally I was physics. That's a long story. But then I switched to English and history. My grades were fantastic. It was really easy. They told me I should be an English professor. Reality is, that's stuff that I could have done for fun. I could have read those books in my spare time. So there's no need to go to school for that. If you're going to go to school, learn something you can't learn on your own. for most people, that's mathematics, programming, physics. It's the STEM disciplines. It's having access to the tools and the people and the rigor and the discipline and the exercises to go ahead and do that. Now, if you are at the level where you can learn STEM disciplines on your own, then you may not need to go to a university. Then the remaining reasons for you to go to a university are the alumni network plus the credentialing. And credentialing, at least in the programming environment, you can get on your own to some extent. Alumni network, it would be a little harder to build, but if you can get a good internship or a good job, you might just want to drop right into that. But obviously that only applies for exceptional people. Yeah, for medicine also, you can't get like high quality medical training on your own in your backyard. So you would have to go to school for that. So it's a fairly narrow set of things. You don't need to go to school to like, I love philosophy. Half the books I'm reading at any given time are essentially philosophy books, but I wouldn't go to school for philosophy. I didn't study philosophy in school. What about art school for designers? It's hard to say. I'm not a designer myself, nor am I very artistic outside of manipulating words, but at least from my faraway sense, is that a truly great artist or designer doesn't actually need to go to school. But that only applies for the top 1%, and you probably have to be self-aware enough to know if you're in that top 1% truly or not. Probably if you're asking the question, you should go to school. Hi, Dave. Yeah, so I think now what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna switch to the tweet storm. And I'm going to go through a couple of things that I didn't actually tweet out. Yeah, so one thing that I think is important to keep in mind is that we all have many, many desires in life. There's lots of things we want to do. We want to be fit. We want to be healthy. We want to be happy. We want to be rich. We want to be with our, with the perfect mate. The problem is, when your desires are that split up, what you're doing is you're creating massive amounts of anxiety. You're losing your focus. So what you really want to do is you want to pick the one thing you care about more than anything else, and you want to ignore everything else. You want to ignore everything else in a rational way, because otherwise you'll never have peace of mind. So you just have to sort of accept the situation that you have with everything else, and you sort of have to focus on the thing you care about. So if you're going to make money, it has to be your number one desire. I'm sorry to say it. I'm not saying that'll necessarily make you happy in other ways, but it's very, very hard to be successful in business while you're trying to live a well-rounded life. You can change it later once you're above a certain level of success. But if you want to be happy, then making money as a way to be happy is the wrong route. You essentially want to just go straight for happiness. Somebody asked a good question, but unfortunately I missed it. Let's see. Someone asked a question about decision making. So I put up a tweet recently that said, if you can't decide, the answer is no. And I think that's the reason I have decision making heuristics that I use. And actually, there are three decision-making heuristics that I use. And it's very hard to come up with a decision-making heuristic because there's infinite choices we're making all day long. And trying to figure out like some rule that apply to all the choices is really difficult. So obviously, these rules are not going to apply to everything. You have to be intelligent about when to use them and when not to use them. But I'll tell you my three decision-making heuristics. First is, if I'm faced with a difficult choice, such as, should I marry this person? Should I take this job? Should I buy this house? Should I move to this city? Should I go in business with this person? If you cannot decide, the answer is no. And the reason is because modern society is full of options. There are tons and tons of options. We live in a planet of 7 billion people. We are connected to everybody on the internet. There's hundreds of thousands of careers available to you. There are so many choices. You're biologically not built to realize how many choices there are, because we evolved in tribes of 150 people, where if you pass up one choice, the second thing never comes along. Also, when you choose something, it takes, you get locked in for a long time. If you start a business, that's 10 years. You get into a relationship, that's 5 years, maybe more. You move to a city, that's 10, 20 years. So these are very, very long-lived decisions. So it's very, very important that you only say yes when you are pretty certain. You're never going to be absolutely certain, but you're going to be very positive. If you find yourself creating a spreadsheet for a decision with a list of yeses and nos and pros and cons and checks and balances and why, you know, why this is good or why that's bad, forget it. You have to internalize it in your gut and in your heart, and you have to really want something before you go for it. So my first decision-making heuristic is, if you cannot decide, the answer is no. By the way, I would ask everybody to hold your questions until I'm done with the three decision-making heuristics, because I'm not reading anymore right now. The second decision-making heuristic that I use is, if you have two choices to make, such as, do I tell this person A or do I tell them B, or do I take job A or job B, do I make this sacrifice now or do I go ahead and do what I want, whatever it is. If you have two choices, and they're relatively equal choices, like it looks 50-50 to you. This is key. For choices where it's lopsided, you know, one's 75, the other one's 25, obviously go with a 75. But if it looks equal to you, A or B, and you can't decide, take the path that is more difficult and more painful in the short term. Because what's actually going on is one of these paths requires short-term pain, and the other one maybe requires pain further out in the future. And what your brain is doing through conflict avoidance is it's trying to push off the short-term pain. And by definition, if the two are even and one has short-term pain, that means it has long-term gain. And by the law of compound interest, the long-term gain is where you want to go towards anyway. So your brain is overvaluing the side that has the short-term happiness, and it's trying to avoid the one with short-term pain. So you have to cancel that tendency out, and it's a powerful subconscious tendency by leaning into the pain. As most of you know, most of the gains in life come from suffering in the short term so you can get paid in the long term. Working out, like for me, is not fun. I suffer in the short term, I feel that pain, but then in the long term, I'm better off because I have muscles or I'm healthier. The same way, if I am reading a book, and I'm getting confused, if like I can't understand what's going on, that's just like working out and the muscle getting sore or tired or filling with lactic acid, but it's not just my brain is being overwhelmed. But in the long run, I'm getting smarter because I'm absorbing new concepts sort of at the limit or edge of my capability. So you generally want to lean into things that have short-term pain but have long-term gain. My trainer, Jerzy Gregorek, aka the creator of the Happy Body, he has a beautiful short saying where he says, hard choices, easy life, easy choices, hard life. So what he means by that is, if you make the hard choices in the short term, like, oh, I shouldn't eat bad carbs or processed foods, or I should go ahead and do the workout, which is difficult, and I don't feel like doing it, then in the long term, I'm going to have an easy life. But if I make the easy choices in the short term, like I'm going to stay out drinking, I'm going to go party, I'm not going to do my work right now, I'm not going to meditate, whatever it is, then in the long term, you're going to have a very difficult life. You will not have built up that self-discipline. So that is my second heuristic for decision making. And now I'm going to talk about the third heuristic for decision making. The third one is a little different. The first one was focused on making the right long-term decision. The second one was on choosing how to split between two otherwise even paths. The third one is about cultivating peace of mind. And peace of mind is very important because it is the precursor to happiness. Happiness is one of those things that cannot be chased directly. If you chase happiness directly, what you're actually chasing is pleasure, and pleasure eventually comes with a withdrawal symptom. Like if pleasure is a high, and then you crash down. Pleasure is a Ferris wheel that you get on, you ride it up, and then eventually you ride it back down. But if you actually want to be happy, if you want to be content, that comes from peace. And so the third decision-making heuristic is, if you're having, and this is very helpful in times of interpersonal conflict, where you're trying to figure out whether to say something to somebody or not, that might make them angry or might get something off your chest, make the choice that will leave you more equanimous. Equanimous is sort of a fancy word for internally calm and settled. Make the choice that will leave you more equanimous at the in the long term. And this one I can't take credit for. I got it from Kapil Gupta. He's on Twitter as well as Kapil Gupta MD, or Siddha Performance. I forget which account he's using right now. But basically, whichever choice will leave you calmer in the long term is actually the right one. If you walk away from making a choice and you still have internal turmoil, then eventually you're going to want to turn around and reverse that choice. So this helps you from having regrets. So those are kind of my three decision-making heuristics. What was the one most important thing you did to become successful? Yeah. Anyone who's known me for a long time knows that my defining characteristic, it was actually a combination of, it's not intelligence, it's not reading, it's a combination of being very impatient and willful. So I don't like to wait. I hate wasting time. I am very, very famous for being rude at parties, events, dinners, where if I'm sitting there and the moment I figure out it's a waste of my time, I get up and I leave. I went to a dinner at a friend's house recently where I went with my wife, and it was a small, intimate 12-person dinner party. And we were supposed to, and my friend had put together a very elaborate affair where we were going to sit there, and it was like this fancy thing where you're blindfolded and then other people kind of feed you for 4 hours while you have conversation. And that sounded terrible to me. And so I got up and I left after 10 minutes, even though it was this massive paid event, supposed to be a very fancy dinner. And my friend understood, because he's a good friend of mine and he knows how I think, so he let me get away with it. But I've been doing that my entire life. The moment I figure out something is a waste of time, I leave immediately. So I have no time for tedious dinners, tedious ceremonies, tedious people. I have no time for formality. I have no time for dressing up. I have no time, business trips. Like, I look back on my, this happened about 5 or 6 years ago. I looked back on my career and I looked at all the business trips I'd taken in my life. And I said, how many of these were actually worthwhile, especially given that I had to spend 3 or 5 or 7 days away from my home, my family, and all the productivity that I could have had, both in business. I had to ruin my health because I'm eating out, I'm not working out regularly. And I came to the decision that business trips are never worth it. So I just stopped going to business trips. And all of this is broken glass. It does annoy people. But fundamentally, where I'm going with this is I valued my time. Value your time. It is all you have. It is more important than your money. It's more important than your friends. It's more important than your anything. Your time is all you have. Do not waste your time. And that doesn't mean you can't relax. I mean, what am I doing right now? I'm wasting time on Periscope by some people's definition. But I'm doing what I want. So that's okay. So as long as you're doing what you want, that's not a waste of your time. But if you're spending your time not doing what you want, and you're not earning, and you're not learning, then what the heck are you doing? Don't spend your time making other people happy. Other people being happy is their problem. It's not your problem. If you are happy, it makes other people happy. If you are happy, other people will ask you how you're happy, and they might learn from it. But you are not responsible for making other people happy. People are asking how I dealt with my wife. Well, in walking out of the party, honestly, my wife knows me. One other belief I have is that when you are going into a relationship, you want to be very selfish. You want to be your worst self, because what happens is we go into relationships and we put on an act for a while. But the reality is that you can't keep an act on your entire life. So eventually your true nature will emerge. So it's really good to be your worst, most selfish self early in a relationship. Not so early that you can't even get the second date, but early enough the person has a very realistic sense of who you are, and you want them to be their natural selves. You want to see them as they are. And so I was very explicit with my wife from early on that nobody restricts my freedom. I am a completely free person at all times and all places. And so anyone who's ever going to have expectations out of me or tell me what to do, it's just not going to work. But at the same time, she has her freedom to do what she wants. She could have walked out of that event and I could have stayed there and it would have been no problem with me. How do I deal with failure? Failure sucks, but if you didn't have failure, you'd never improve, you'd never change. If we didn't fail in life, then one thing I heard is that that I liked is that if you got everything out of life that you wanted, if you always got what you wanted, you'd probably still be living in your hometown, you'd be married to your high school sweetheart, you'd be like the manager at your first job, right? So it's important to fail, because failure is what causes us to get up and move and to change, and through change we get growth. So failure is just a path towards growth. So as long as the failure led to your growing and improving, it's not failure. It's like when I lift weights, I'm lifting weights to failure, right? I'm deliberately going for failure. Why? Because that's the point at which my muscle will grow. And I don't want to injure myself, so I don't want to fail so hard that I can't recover. And I don't want to not learn from it. I don't want to fail lifting a weight, drop it, and then never come back. But small amounts of control failure that you learn from is exactly how you grow. It is a part of the process, and there is no way around it. And I know that it's hard to feel that way when you've just tried for something so hard and you failed. But it's just important to keep going. Everybody fails all the time. Oh, let me talk about one tweet that somebody took a piece of something I'd set out of context and they retweeted it, and nobody understood what the heck it meant. And I'm going to talk about that. And the point was, I said, 99% of effort is wasted. And obviously, nothing is ever wasted, because it's all a learning moment. You can learn from anything. But what I meant was, when you go back to school, for example, 99% of the term papers that you did, the books that you read, the exercises that you did, the things you learned, they don't really apply. You might have read geography and history that you never reuse. You might have studied a language that you don't speak anymore. You might have studied a branch of mathematics that you completely forgot. Now, of course, these are learning experiences. You did learn. You learned the value of hard work. You might have learned something that went deep into your psyche and became a piece of what you're doing. But at least when it comes to the goal-oriented life, only about 1% of the efforts that you made paid off. For example, all the people that you dated until you met your husband or wife, right? It was a kind of wasted time in the goal sense. Not wasted in the experiential sense, not wasted in the learning sense, but definitely wasted in the goal sense. The reason I say that is not to make some glib comment about, ooh, 99% of your life is wasted and only 1% is useful. I make that to say that you should be very thoughtful and realize that in most things, whether it's in relationships or in work or even in learning, what you're trying to do is you're trying to find the thing that you can go all into with compound interest. So when you're dating, the instant you know this relationship is not going to be the one that leads to marriage, you should probably move on. You should probably stop that relationship and move on to the next person. When you're studying something, like if you're taking a geography class or a history class, and you're realizing that it's not working out, you're just never going to use this information, drop the class. It's a waste of time. It's a waste of your brain energy. So I'm not saying don't do the 99%. It's very hard to identify what that 1% is. But what I'm saying is, when you find that 1% in whatever discipline you're in that's not going to be wasted, that you're able to invest in for the rest of your life and that has meaning to you, then go all in on that and forget about the rest. people are asking about tips for generating passive income. Passive income comes from owning a piece of a business. There are many, many different ways to own a piece of a business. You can do it by investing, you can do it by starting, you can do it by being helpful. You can do it by taking some of your compensation for working for a business in equity, depending on the business. I think I'm probably going to bounce out soon. My throat's getting dry, I'm out of tea, so I'll do one last round and then I'm going to drop out. So, okay, I have a good one to leave on. Someone asked me, what did I mean by the last tweet in the How to Get Rich tweet storm? The last tweet said, when you get there, you'll realize that it's not really what you were looking for in the first place. It's a little glib. What I mean by that is that making money is not going to make you happy. What making money will do is it will solve your money problems. It will remove a set of things that were in the way of being happy, but it is not in of itself going to make you happy. I know many unhappy, very wealthy people. As I said before, happiness comes from peace. But and most of the time, the person you have to become to make money is a high anxiety, high stress, high work, competitive person. And when you have been doing that for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, and then you suddenly make money, you can't turn that off. You've trained yourself, you've conditioned yourself in such a way that you are now just a high anxiety person. So now you have to learn how to be happy. And how to be happy is a much more complex, much deeper topic, which I hope to get into at some point. But I would say that it starts with one very simple thing, which is, you truly have to believe that happiness is a choice you make and it's a skill that you develop. It is not necessarily an intrinsic quality. You aren't stuck where you started. It's not a static thing. Everyone has a different body, but almost everybody can be fit if they work hard enough at it. So the same way, everyone has a different mind and starts a different DNA in the mind, in the brain, but if you work at it, you can become a lower stress, lower anxiety person. I would say that, if you checked in on me 10 years ago, I would have been, and if you'd asked me how happy I was, I would have dismissed the question. I didn't like to talk about it, but I would have said I'm like a 2 out of 4, or 3 out of 4, or a 2 out of 10, or 3 out of 10, or maybe even a 4 out of 10 on my best days. But I did not value being happy. Today, I'm a 9 out of 10. And yes, having money helps, but it's actually a very small piece of it. Most of it is just, I've learned over the years that my own happiness is the most important thing to me. I've cultivated it through a series of techniques. I have lowered my identity. I have lowered the chattering of my mind. I don't care that much about things that don't really matter. I don't get involved in politics. I don't hang around unhappy people. I really value my time on this earth. I read philosophy. I meditate. I hang around with happy people. And it works. You can very slowly but steadily and methodically improve your happiness baseline, just like you can improve your fitness, just like you can improve your intellect by reading. So all of that is absolutely possible. But it first begins with just believing that it's possible. If you look at medicine, there's something in medicine called the placebo effect. And that is basically, if I take a medicine and it's not real, it's a sugar pill like homeopathy, if I believe that it's real, it actually has a chance of working for a certain class of ailments. If I have a headache and I take a pill that I think will cure my headache, even if that pill turns out not to be real or have anything in it, there's a reasonable chance it will just cure my headache through the placebo effect because I believed it was real. But the placebo effect is not something you should fall into easily, because if I have cancer and somebody gives me a placebo cancer pill and I take it thinking it's going to work, it's probably not going to work. The placebo effect is not that powerful, especially for physical things of the body. And I might die because I'm too busy doing placebo effect medicines when really I need chemotherapy or something more extreme intervention. But when it comes to placebo effects of the mind, it's actually really good to believe, because placebo effects of the mind, there's very few downside consequences. If someone says to me, hey, meditation will make you happier, I should go in with a positive mindset, because I control my own entire internal world, and whatever I believe to be true is very likely to be true. There's very little physics to override like there might be with the physical body. So when it comes to placebo effects of the mind, you should always go in positively inclined. So the first step to being happier is just to believe that you can be happier and that it's your choice. And it's a skill that you can develop just like any other skill. So that's it. I'm going to leave it on that. Thank you all very much, and I hope to see you all on Twitter and Periscope very soon. Bye-bye.